connected to mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vanelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, the vampire Lestat. That and more next. So, stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Carol Pope.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir.
Hi, I'm Lorraine Segato.
Hi, I'm Gord Depp of the Spoons. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada, as well as being a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. And all of that is thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading. So today, award-winning New York Times bestselling author Christopher Rice is my guest and joins me to talk about his latest queer novel, Party of Three. Plus, the enduring nature of the interview with the vampire characters, including the vampire Lestat. And we'll find out about the Anne Rice and All Saints Day celebration. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. And on this episode, I'm featuring some classic funk, some queer punk, and more. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. And our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, novelist and screenwriter Melanie Messner reads from her latest novel, Slow Reveal, a book about a lesbian affair, emotional infidelity, addiction, and the creative process.
Naomi drifted off to the dark well of longing for those snowy nights in East Marion, where she paced, reciting her work to Catherine, before ravishing her on the living room floor as the last of the embers in the fireplace extinguished. Shut out from the rest of their lives, shut down, yet gloriously open to the moment, which lingered on endlessly, as though the entirety of their existence were encapsulated in a single instant. She left the reading at St. Mark's Church, crossed Avenue A near First, spotted a phone booth and stopped. In the short space of time she could talk herself out of the urgency, she stepped up to the receiver. Catherine answered, but at first she didn't hear Naomi's voice over the din of traffic. "It's me. I'm out on the street in the East Village," she said. "Something wrong? I haven't heard from you. Not that you're under any obligation to stay in touch, but I want to be there for you, Katie. Be there in a way that might be, I don't know, beneficial. You sound like a doctor." Naomi realized how calculating she was, the way passion shape-changed into need, then shape-changed into something more desperate, a false narrative projected onto the object of desire in the form of support. One thing she knew for sure, woman, when faced with another woman, could not escape the truth. I wanted to check on you. I'm all right, I guess. I don't know. Catherine moved through her uncorrupted. Okay, I'll admit it. I needed to hear your voice. Look, I have to go, Catherine said. She was on the floor of the walk-in, surrounded by small paintings on paper. I'm making an inventory of Jonathan's work, you know, for his retrospective. Why did she have to mention him? Here she was, trapped by the longing, caught in the net, snared, while Catherine was back in the closet, comforted by a ghost, the part of Jonathan she loved and admired, the legacy he left behind. Death was a form of black magic, the way it clutched survivors in its grip. All mortal acts attained a kind of immortality through the recognition by others. The dying mortal, but the death immortalized. The artist mortal, but the art immortalized. This act we call life, the very definition of mortality, immortalized through every appeal, every retreat, every request, and every confession. What arrogance, the very idea that Catherine's function was to serve her own, as if all relationships serve that purpose. Something was seriously wrong with that line of reasoning, passionless and bloody. Naomi didn't like messes she couldn't clean up with her deft handling of language. Had she viewed their relationship as immortal, as if it would never perish? Or was she busy building a security force to hide behind, an armed one to keep out intruders, especially dead ones? She looked at the sign Van in block letters written across the shop window. Racks of French and Italian wines lined the floor-to-ceiling walls. She remembered that unctuous Cote Roti after cycling 36 miles around the fluvial terraces of the Rhone Valley, what seemed like a million summers ago. 2 weeks of uninterrupted bliss, riding hard by day against the bleached out sun, grapes glistening on the vines, that year producing a superior vintage. Basking in the eerie glow of candelabras and castles en route, where they dined in cellars and slept in medieval rooms with stone fireplaces. On one particular stormy night, the last one of their trip, they huddled in front of a roaring fire and Catherine admitted she was missing Jonathan, that she didn't feel free of him, that he was ingrained in her like a genetic imprint. Devastated by her confession, Naomi hoped she wouldn't hear the same lamentation recounted over a candlelit dinner, this time at her loft, that is, if ever they were reunited. She was feeling possessive. If she didn't protect the relationship, no one would. Seduced by love, then slaughtered by it. That's how she envisioned the outcome if she allowed herself to go that far. Naomi tried on every jacket and every pair of pants hanging in her cramped closet. Her indecision had nothing to do with vanity, but in some perverse way, she would replace Jonathan at his own memorial service. Attending wasn't her idea. Catherine insisted on it. She needed her there, but never explained why. The macabre image of funerals as weekly tributes triggered that dreadful time in her life. She'd been to so many over the years for friends and artists who died of cancer and AIDS. They were her peers, just like Jonathan, not her elders. Death, unlike life, had become a close friend, intimate, dependable, remarkable in ways, someone she could trust. Someone who reliably showed up only after a brief absence and never lacked enthusiasm for her own personal struggle. This, she said, dangling the leather harness she used to seduce Catherine, is completely inappropriate. Therefore, I will wear it fully accessorized. Her somber mood was broken by this crazy gesture, the inanity of it all. She imagined cutting through the crowd of mourners yelling, "Thou art art," pointing to the urn of Jonathan's ashes. Cruel and unbecoming, yes, but honest. Why weren't people honest anymore? Have lies been told so often they now appeared absolute and irrefutable? She dropped the brief she planned to wear, walked into the living room sporting her harness and over to the window where she pulled up the shades and yelled, "Cocks and crows be damned, I stand before thee naked, a woman, a man, a monster." And she cackled and crowed maddeningly before whisking a bottle off the cabinet, lifting the cork and guzzling it down, then spraying her woolen rug with a shower of ruby wine rubbing it in for good measure with the heel of her bare foot. Sick and tired of the tidy lies, she fixated on the stain. There will be no more deception between us. In Catherine's absence, she could not dispute her claim. The act revitalized her, and her dynamism returned. She acknowledged the pulsating rhythm of her sex locked up in a harness, felt the energy bound up and turned inward. She wasn't fixed in a singular mindset about what makes a man, what makes a woman. To her, it was not the body or the genitals, but the orientation of energy. It hadn't been easy, not because of her identity, but because of her disorientation around gender, like those little icons stuck on the walls of public toilets, indicating which door to use. She rarely interpreted the symbols correctly. They made no sense, which accounted for the way she often walked blindly into the wrong bathroom. As if there were no subtleties in the evolution of the human race, we must define, we must confine. She glanced at the clock over the kitchen stove and dashed into the bedroom to dress. If she didn't pull herself together, she'd be late for the memorial service. She wanted to be there on time, even though she knew her presence would probably make things worse. And she hated herself, their relationship, for that.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. Loot, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, Christopher Rice.
Hi. Hi, I'm Syeda Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Christopher Rice, hello. Hi, how are you?
I am very well. How are you doing?
I am good. I am good. Thank you for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. And returning to Rainbow Country, I am honored. So thank you for this.
Of course.
We're going to touch on some subjects like your latest queer novel, A Party of Three, a new illustrated edition of the novel, Interview with the Vampire, by, of course, your late mom, the late, great, the one and only Anne Rice, as well as Anne Rice and All Saints Day celebration. We're going to talk about all of those things. You have a lot on your plate, Mr. Christopher Rice. I just mentioned three little things.
Hello. Oh, little. Yeah.
Generally speaking, Mr. Christopher Rice, generally speaking, how are you feeling about all of these things? Celebrating your mom, coming out with a new book. How are you feeling about all of these things that are surrounding you right now?
Well, I feel proud of myself for being able to do them all. I feel very fortunate that people want to do them all with me. I think that the celebration of life, as we used to call it, and now we call it, as you accurately said, Anne Rice and All Saints Day celebration, that was an event that we did not want to rush into production because we've only got one chance to do it, and we wanted to do it right. My producing partner, Eric Shaw Quinn, who's also my podcasting co-host at thedinnerpartyshow.com, he and I have been working on this probably from the moment Anne passed away, because we knew she died in December of 2021, and it was immediately clear that there were still far too many COVID restrictions in place to do any kind of public ceremony. And we supported those restrictions wholeheartedly. So we had a very private funeral for her, which was just the immediate family graveside at Metairie Cemetery in New Orleans. We shared footage that we took with the fan base so that they could feel included. But I promised, perhaps too rashly, that within the coming year after her passing, we would have a big, massive public celebration. Well, big, massive public celebrations take a long time to plan. And so as we got into the logistics of it, it became immediately clear that we were not going to be able to do something that was really worthy of her in that amount of time. And the biggest thing, one of the bigger things that happened in terms of our planning, was that we sent out a sort of exploratory email, if you will. We set up a newsletter and we said, if you sign up for this newsletter, you're not committing to attending this event, but you are giving us a sense of the level of interest out there about coming to the event. And we had 5,000 people sign up for the newsletter in about 48 hours. So that's, we set out in search of a venue that could accommodate 5,000 people, and we couldn't find a venue that big, but we found one that is wonderful and beautiful and historic. And obviously, you know, over time, people who sign up for an email address may not be able to attend the event once the date was announced. But that added to the thoughtfulness with which we went about this. So I think that has really, I have to say, you know, you put out three things and I went to that one first, because that's honestly where the majority of my time is spent these days, because we're going to have a sort of documentary film element to the celebration. It's going to have live musical performances, speakers. It's going to have a beautiful scenic design. We're really putting a lot into this, and we're going to be filming the event itself. So we're going to capture it for all time, and we will broadcast it in a free, accessible manner after the date so that we can share it with people who were not able to attend for whatever reason. So that's really exciting, but there have been moments where it has felt overwhelming, and we've pushed through it. Eric is a wonderful business partner and comes from a theater and advertising background, so he knows a lot about how to go about something like this. But I think it explains why Party of Three is really a novella and not a novel. So my Sapphire Cove fans didn't get a full-length book this year because I knew that I wasn't going to have time to write one. But I'm currently working on what I see as the last big novel in the series, which is Sapphire Thunder, that's scheduled for release next year. And that will be the story of Jonas, who is an ongoing character in the series with a secret past in the intelligence world. And I'm going to cue him up for his own story. Hopefully it'll be out next summer. We'll see. But Party of Three was part of a kind of a desire on my part to have sampler is maybe the wrong word, but for people who are unsure about the series or they wanted a little taste of the world, I gave them this incredibly steamy story about basically three guys who spend a weekend together in one of the hotel's villas and end up in a throuple. So it was meant to be very, very straight to the point and very hot and very... light is maybe not the right word for it because it deals with some serious issues, but it's supposed to be a tasty treat. Let me put it that way. And at that, I forget the third thing. Oh, right, the illustrated edition. And those have just been wonderful. We've been working with a company out of the UK called Books Illustrated, and they're so collaborative, you know, and I've just included us in every step of the way. We've got... The Interview with the Vampire edition is already for sale. They're working on one for The Witching Hour, which is just, I'm so excited. They've shared some of the illustrations online. It's a different artist, very different style. It's more Art Nouveau, which I think is kind of the perfect way to capture the portraits of the Mayfair women. And so, yeah, there's a lot going on. And it is an honor. It's an honor to be entrusted with this estate. You know, Eric and I are overseeing kind of everything Anne Rice through the world, everything Anne Rice in publishing through the world of Dinner Partners, our production company. And we have a lot of exciting things we want to do with her work across all media in the years to come. So, yeah, I'm a workaholic. You got me.
Let me ask you this question. Do you see yourself, or do you separate the mother, Anne Rice, from the professional author and best-selling author, Anne Rice? Is there a separation for you?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, it is a little blurry because she was so public on Facebook with her day-to-day life. And she was so interactive with her fans. So I think there is a sense of familiarity that her fans had with her and by extension with me and by extension with Eric, who was her very close friend. So I think she wasn't incredibly guarded in that respect. So you did kind of what you were seeing was what you were getting in many respects. But as a mother, she was an absolute champion for individuality. She said to me repeatedly throughout my youth, don't be a conformist. This was particularly acute. There was a big move in my early childhood. When I was 10 years old in 1988, we moved from San Francisco to New Orleans. And the move was really, I don't know if precipitated was the right word. The move was inspired by my mother's success. She had really started with the novel The Vampire Lestat in 1985 or 86. I think it was released in 86. She really broke through to a new level of success. It debuted on the New York Times bestsellers list at number 9. A lot of people don't realize this, but the novel Interview with the Vampire was a flop when it was first published. The story gets told inaccurately that it was this runaway hit in the 70s and everything was just roses. It wasn't. It was actually kind of a flop, and she went on to write two historical novels. Very good books, which are beloved today, but they were not runaway bestsellers. But during that time, the novel Interview with the Vampire garnered this cult following that started to grow and grow and grow and grow. So by the time she went back with a sequel that sort of looked at that world through an entirely new point of view, which was Lestat's point of view, there was all this energy behind it that put the book on the bestseller list. So she didn't want to live in San Francisco anymore. And my father was sort of burned out as a professor at San Francisco State University. He was kind of done. He wanted to focus on poetry and his painting. So they told me we were moving to New Orleans for the summer. And then I was being enrolled in school in New Orleans. And I went, summer's over. What's up? And that was how we moved. We stayed. To get back to your question, the mothering style that she employed was just because we have moved from a very progressive, eccentric community does not mean you should start forcing yourself to follow the crowd. It was a different environment. It was more socially conservative. It was more politically conservative where we moved to. I think New Orleans has this reputation as this wild libertine place, but the fact of the matter is that a lot of its white communities tilt right. And so that's kind of where we were. But we were there because she thought the best educational opportunities were there. And we were living in a neighborhood, a historic neighborhood that was very beautiful, where she had longed to live as a little girl. But she was very strong, very much about me maintaining my individuality and being the catalyst. That was a word she used. She said, there was a moment where I was changing to a new high school. I had gone to a kind of elementary school, I guess, or maybe a junior high, and it was over. You graduated in eighth grade, and it was time to go off to high school. And I didn't want to go to this high school. It was a very esteemable school, academically very solid, wonderful teachers. They recruited from all over the country, but it was very football dominated, and that. There was a sort of mix there of, yeah, I felt like as a theater kid, I was not going to necessarily fit in, but that testosterone-filled atmosphere was teasing at my sexuality in a way that I was deeply uncomfortable with in that moment. And I didn't want to go to the school. And she said, you can go to this school and be in charge of your own experience. You can be the catalyst of your social environment. If you don't see a social group that you belong to, make one. That's what I did. She said that of herself when she went to, when she moved to Texas when she was 14. So it was very, you know, she was very encouraging of me. And I often say it's wonderful that I actually wanted to be an artist, because if I hadn't, she might not have understood me. You know, she was the opposite of most parents who are like, you want to do what? You want to write? What is this? How are you going to make any money? She was like, follow your dreams. And I think the end result of that is that we became very close friends as adults. We became almost more like peers and colleagues.
Okay. Party of three.
Yes.
A couple words, steamy, explicit, a novella, basically about a thruple, Jeff mm-hmm. Buckley Mateo. Mateo is interesting, a Marine Corps veteran dealing mm-hmm. with PTSD in this thruple, in this steamy romance, novella. Why did you want to talk about and include PTSD in this novella, in this novel?
I write about military men a lot. I've been in relationships with military men. I live in Hello. Southern California. Yeah. I live in Southern California, and there's a heavy military presence here, specifically down in San Diego, which is my mother used to actually live down there. So I was there a lot. And Logan Murdoch, who is one of the heroes of the first book in the Sapphire Cove series, very much a former Marine officer. Previously, with the exception of some references in a thriller I wrote years ago as Christopher Rice, I'd never really delved into PTSD. And it was starting to feel like I was milking this type for all of its sexual desirability, but I wasn't addressing one of the biggest psychological issues that that community faces. And I didn't necessarily want it to consume the entire book, because it is a romance story. It is meant to be an erotic escape in many ways, but it is about how these three men are not just going to have a hot three-way together over the course of a weekend, but actually end up in a committed thruple with each other. And I always believe my sort of romance writing model is that it's incredibly attractive for one hero or heroine to work on their deep-seated issues to improve their relationship with the other character, with their partner, or in this case, partners, plural. And so if Mateo was going to not open his relationship, but expand his relationship in this way, he was going to have to deal with this thing he wasn't facing head on, which is that he had acute claustrophobia as a result of a training accident, essentially. And I like the idea that his unwillingness to deal with it and his sense of embarrassment and shame around it was exacerbated by the fact that it wasn't a combat incident, that he felt like he didn't have a right to complain or to have these severe reactions to being in an elevator or whatever, just because he was trapped in the cabin of a sinking aircraft, which is what happened. I also wanted to draw a little bit of attention to the Osprey, because it is a very problematic aircraft that has killed 52 Marines. And I understand that they're working on it and trying to improve it, but it is a dangerous thing that was taking lives. So I like, as shiny, as glossy, as sexy as the writing is, I like there to be some threads of reality woven through it, some threads of issues. You know, I think it is important to for a writer to decide what they're going to use their platform to promote. You know, I don't think every fictional story needs to be broken down into political components necessarily, but I do think we make choices as writers to shine our light on one thing as opposed to another thing. And those were two things I wanted to shine a light on. I love bringing edges of queerness into this genre. I think there is more of it lately. I think it's getting increasingly diverse. I think when we started in 2014, we didn't, and I say started because that was when the smaller presses that were doing queer romance, primarily for an audience of women, they were gaining steam, and they were using the digital power of the e-books and the internet to basically create a market for something that had been in forms and fan fiction for free before. But because the authors of all the work were using pseudonyms, and rightfully so, because the pseudonym in romance was about trying not to lose your job, right? Particularly if you worked in education. But because of those pseudonyms, we didn't realize how queer and diverse and LGBT the writing roster actually was. We didn't realize how many of those women were bi, how many of those women were trans, how many of the men were transmasculine. Like, we had no idea, because they were necessarily protecting themselves behind a long tradition in romance writing that goes back to, you know, the beginning of the genre. So I think that has become more evident, and I think we have more openly queer people in the space talking about it, getting on TikTok about it, all that sort of stuff. We have more diverse character arrangements than we had back then. Back then it was just two cisgender men, usually white, you know, and some of the publishers were really brazen in how they addressed that reality. This is how it has to be, they would tell authors. And I think what we had that I think is necessarily loosened up, and I'm glad to see it, was we had a lot of women who wanted to write sapphic romance being told they couldn't, being told that if they were going to write it, it had to be two boys, and those were the only choices they had. And so they have since found a platform for what they want to do. But I enjoy being part of that trend. And I think, but on my end, what I bring to it is usually what's authentically going on in the heads of grumpy old white gay guys. Because that's my point of view, you know.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
Hi, I'm writer Adam Smith, author of Deep Sniff, A History of Poppers and Queer Futures. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TG CD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist, providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Terra for providing this platform for all of us.
If you, or maybe someone you know, would like to be a guest on Rainbow Country to get the word out about an upcoming project, maybe you have an interesting story or journey to share, well, simply head over to marktara.ca where everything is connected and send me an email. It's just that simple. And you too can have your voice and your story be heard coast to coast.
Hi, my name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Terra on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station, specifically for our issues, to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Terra providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
So, Christopher Rice.
Yes.
Can we talk about some basically 50-year-old vampires?
50-year-old vampires?
Yeah.
Is which that okay? Which ones did you have in mind? Well, we do have Interview with the Vampire. The novel is celebrating its 50th anniversary next year.
Absolutely. Okay. So here we go. 1994, Interview with the Vampire, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
63% Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
7.5 out of 10 on IMDb. 3 out of 4... Roger Ebert. That's the movie, Interview with the Vampire.
Mm-hmm.
2022, Interview with the Vampire, the TV series, 98% Rotten Tomatoes, 7.5 out of 10 on IMDb, 83% Metacritic. So here's my first question in regards to these characters. Why do you think, going on almost 50 years, why do you think these characters arguably are more popular today in modern day times than they were back in 1976? Why do you think they resonate still to this day?
You know, it's an amazing question. It gets back to, well, I think Anne was always ahead of her time, right? And so that's part of it. I think that Anne was writing what she was passionate about. She was writing without regard for the market. She was writing about what possessed her. And I think she was observing the beginning of a queer identity that was taking shape around her in Northern California as a result of the social revolutions of the 60s and the 70s. It wasn't anything like the community that we know and experience today. It was part of this sort of, you know, like may seem like an odd answer to this question. So I had a book club with my friends a few years ago, and we read On the Road by Jack Kerouac, which is a classic novel considered by many. And we didn't get it. We really didn't. We didn't get it. I mean, we were just reading. It's the prose seemed accomplished, but it was just about two men who literally went on the road and did things, you know, met people who lived there. It's not a sort of grand classic novel. It's not a hero's journey. We didn't understand. We went to my mom and we said, because we knew she had an affection for the book. And we said, what's the deal with this? And she said, you have to understand how revolutionary it was back then when that book was written to actually just go on the road. Like back then, you stayed in your box, you stayed in your town, you took the most obvious job, you got married, you had kids. That was the life in that they were expected to live in the 1950s. And they both graduated high school around 1960, 1961. And at my mother's funeral, my aunt, my father's sister, told a story to my best friend, Eric Shaw Quinn, which he repeated to me, which I had never heard in this kind of detail, of how Ann and Stan one day just packed up their truck, somebody else's truck. I think it was actually a family member's truck that they had given to them. And they just drove out to Northern California with no job prospect, no idea of where they were going to live, no idea of what they were going to do for school. She was dropping out of Texas Women's University to make this trip. And they were just going. They were just going. And that freedom, that ambition, that desire, that refusal to conform is for me what the vampires are about. I mean, that was the beginning of Anne looking at the world and society from outside the conventional mainstream point of view. So when she arrived in San Francisco, there was this hotbed of artistic activity. The beat poet scene was happening. That's why they went. Kerouac was maybe even there. You know, I don't know if they ever met him. And the early depictions of the vampires in the novel Interview with the Vampire, I feel, are very fed by those days. You know, they had the party house where all the artists and the poets came. And I think, you know, one of the heartbreaking stories she told about that time was how this friend of theirs, who was sort of their muse, he was a poet and I think a painter, and they were all gathered one night in the house of in their house, in the living room, and this friend made this beautiful speech about giving it all to your art, giving it all. If you're going to be an artist, you got to give it all. And Anne was very moved, and she ran into this guy the next day on Telegraph Avenue in Berkeley, where they were all living, and she said to him, you know, I was so moved by your speech last night, I'm going to do it. I'm going to write my novel. And he said, oh, no, baby, I was talking about your husband. And that just, you know, but the other side is that I think that inspired her more. I think that inspired her to write her novels more. That sense of being the outsider, which is really what the vampires are about. It's why queer people have always gravitated towards these stories. But it's also, they have a huge audience of not queer people too, who have just felt emotionally and psychologically like they don't see the world the way everybody else does. And so I think that's the resonance of the Anne Rice character, but I think it's in all of her books. I think it's in the Castrati characters of Cry to Heaven. I think it's in the Free People of Color and Feast of All Saints. I think it's in the Mayfair Witches. You know, I think it's in, you know, it's always threaded through her work, and I think it's why it's so appealing. And I also think it's why her work was so distinct from the other authors in the period where she was very successful, which arguably the 90s were the peak of her publishing success. But you look at who else was successful around that time. They weren't writing like her. She wasn't writing like them, nor did anybody need to be writing like anybody else. It's not a failing on anybody's part. But you look, she's often compared, maybe Clive Barker, like that's probably where the greatest similarities were, that sort of queer horror. But I also think Anne was never really fully embracing of the horror label, because what horror meant when Anne was a little girl going to the movie theater was very different than what it meant by 1995. Horror had become very gruesome and very bloody. I remember she would always tell this story. I made her take me to see the fourth Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And I thought she was going to suffer a nervous collapse. She just said, this is not horror. Horror is, you know, black and white Hammer films and gothic, you know. And I think what she loved came to be called more gothic romance. So, but I think the enduring nature of her work is really a fascinating conversation to explore, because a big part of it, you know, Eric and I did this recently. We got curious and we went and we looked up who were the other best-selling novelists at the top of the bestseller list in the years when she had big hits. And a lot of them are names that aren't talked about today, you know, and we're not trying to be like, but it speaks to the point of your question, which is why has this endured? And I think I'm usually a fan of the idea that characters are what sear themselves into the consciousness. I think she hit on something with Lestat that was iconic. And it's not the Lestat of the novel Interview with the Vampire. It's the Lestat of the novel The Vampire Lestat. That became, for her fan base at least, an iconic character because he had this perfect combination of a hero's ambition with that sense of being an outsider. And I think if you read the early chapters of the novel The Vampire Lestat and you're with him in France...
If my memory serves, wasn't he called like Wolf Killer?
Wolf Killer is his slaughtering of the wolves that are menacing his village is his heroic act in the opening of that book. And so when Magnus the vampire begins stalking him in Paris, he keeps saying Wolf Killer. He keeps sending it out as an almost telepathic message. So yes, I think. But the opening, the first part of the novel is called Lelio Rising, which is about his move into the theater world. Lelio is a stock character in Commedia dell'arte, and he becomes to play him. But it's really incredible to look at those early chapters and say, how does this guy become Lestat, the rock star hero, brat prince of the vampire? So I think that character is absolutely iconic, and I think the book series really makes that clear.
Okay. So, you talked about earlier Anne Rice, an All Saints Day celebration happening in happening on November 1st in New Orleans, I believe, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, this is happening in 2025. In 2026, this is when Interview with the Vampire turns 50. Are there any... are you guys planning any sort of celebration, or is this also part of this 50th celebration of these characters?
I would say stay tuned. Stay tuned on the topic of the 50th celebration. You know me, like I said earlier, I don't want to announce anything prematurely, but stay tuned. We will have more to say on that front. But this celebration in November is individual. It is meant to,
celebrate your mom.
Right. We don't use the word funeral, but it is, it is the public participation that we were not able to give at the time of her passing to her fan base.
Your mother, the one and only Anne Rice, world famous author, selling well over 100 million novels worldwide. And this is part of your legacy. This is what you are representing now.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about that and all that encompasses, how does that make you feel representing that legacy?
Blessed, primarily. Blessed. Because it is the legacy that it is. If she'd written a series of highly successful novels about a right-wing detective, I probably wouldn't feel this way, you know, but because it is about all these ideas that I believe in, I'm blessed. It is a big responsibility. It is a lot of work. It is one of the reasons it's so important that Eric Shawquin joined me in it as a producing partner. He was very close friends with her. He knows the books very well, fell in love with the books long before he ever met her, tells the beautiful story about reading them during one of the worst periods of his life and how seen they made him feel. So I feel very fortunate to have him. We have an amazing team of agents and managers and lawyers who work with us on everything, but it is an immense full-time job, because we want to make sure the fan base is respected and engaged and involved with what we're doing. And I think there was absolutely a moment, you know, Anne was very active on Facebook up until practically she passed away. And I thought, what do we do with this page now? It wasn't moderated. So there would be guest admins, but it was really her. And I thought, and so I just went in there and I started posting as myself every Sunday, but I posted a recollection of her. And people really connected with it. They were really loving and supportive. And if they hadn't been, I might have shut the page down or, I don't know, turned it into something else. So that's just one example of the incentives we have been given to keep the estate going, you know, and to keep it alive. But I think, you know, on balance, I feel a great sense of connection with a lot of her fan base. A lot of her fan base is queer men. A lot of her fan base is trans and non-binary people. I feel a great sense of connection with who she brought to the hearth, you know, through her work. I think that she was a scrapper politically on Facebook, which is not something we've carried forward on the page because it's not possible for us to replicate her personal political voice in that way. But we're very clear about what she believes in and what she didn't believe in. And if somebody tries to put words in her mouth from yesterday, we don't usually let that slide. But it is a responsibility. And I think we want her to be remembered. I think that's the most important thing. And right now we have a wonderfully diverse and expansive group of people who are actively remembering her. And so we want to connect with them as much as we can.
I will just say this special illustrated edition, and there are a few variations of them for Interview with the Vampire. On mm-hmm. your socials, you have some unboxing videos.
Yeah.
And they are beautiful. They are gorgeous. Yeah. And I think your mother would be, and I think Anne Rice, the professional, would be, hell yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think
they are spot on. Well done to you on that.
Well, thank you. I wish I could take credit, but it's really the Books Illustrated team is just incredible.
It takes a village.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my last question for you, and it's simply this. You are an award-winning New York Times best-selling novel. You've written well over 20 novels at this point. For yourself, whether it's this latest novel, novella, Party of Three, or whatever it is that you're doing, what do you hope your audiences come away with after they've experienced Christopher Rice, after they've experienced your late great mother, Anne Rice? What do you hope your audience comes away with after experiencing you?
Well, it's a good question, because I really do believe that after you put a book out into the world, that's it. You have to let it go, and you can't control the reaction to it, and you can't police the discourse about it. You just have to. Your time with it was when you were writing it and editing it, and then when that time is over, it now belongs to the readers. So I'm a little hesitant to say what I would want them to come away with. But I think the thing that was most important to me when I started and it stayed consistent is I like to put queer characters in places where you don't usually see them. I like to see queer characters written against restrictive stereotypes. There's some stereotypes I love. I love femmy guys. That's my thing. And so I'm not going to try to practice that warmed over respectability politics that says all queer men need to act like high school principals. You know what I mean? Like I like glittery, fabulous boys and girls and all of all stripes. So I think it's more about seeing those people work in government, in law enforcement, in realms that we don't see them, as private detectives, as superheroes, as all that sort of things. I love to take part in the centering of queer people in places where they're usually marginalized or erased. And I think right now, my love, and this hasn't really filtered into my work yet necessarily, I'm loving historical fiction, and I'm loving reading about history that excavates a lot of erased queer experiences. And I think people should anticipate seeing that in my books to come. I think the Sapphire Cove series is about having a beachy escape. It really is. It's I launched it during the pandemic when things were bad and dark and I couldn't go to the beach, literally, because of restrictions. And it's its own thing. But even those books, they have this this sense of like, not a lot of people have written a romance novel in which you're asked to find, to read as a porn star finds his happily ever after, right? I really do like queering these spaces. I really like that. And it stayed consistent. My books haven't always been, and I've written some books that aren't considered gay at all, but I think that's an idea that's present in some form in all of them.
Well said, well said. Christopher Rice, well said, well done, well written, well curated. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
That was my spotlight on award-winning New York Times best-selling author, Christopher Rice. His latest novel, Party of Three, is out now and available wherever you get your favorite books. For more on this artist, simply visit ChristopherRiceBooks.com. Plus, for all things Anne Rice and All Saints Day celebration, you can visit AnneRice.com. Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, the track is called Long Face from the vampire Lestat de Lioncoeur.
My pretty baby, I've got long fangs. Come appraise me, bring your long stakes. That doesn't faze me. I'm an actor in my makeup. I get fatter when we break up. What does it matter who I take her? Another year, another place, another tear. Pick up the pace, rack up the fears. Now I have a face. You're an allegro, I'm a dante. We're ballero, prostitute. Ooh, 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 ah, ah. Another taste, another year, another place, another tear, another chase, another sneer. Without a trace, you disappear. Pick up the pace, back up the gear. Give me some face, a souvenir. Here come the gaze, here comes the fear. Now I have a face. Now I have a face. Ooh, ah, ah. Ooh, ah, ah. I have a
KPP Concerts has a stacked lineup of all-ages concerts happening at the Broom Factory through the summer into early fall. On June 27th, check out Housewife, followed by Friday's Child at the Broom Factory on July 11th. Then on August 10th, enjoy music from hip-hop artist Matt Mac, followed later by The Dirty Nil on September 19th. Then on September 26th, it's Petite Belle Evo and neo-grunge icons The Bridge City Sinners coming to town on September 27th. And then Yukon Blonde gets us into the fall spirit on September 28th. All shows are all ages at the Broom Factory and co-presented by CFRC 101.9 FM. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.
Hi, this is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.